This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
With Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
And joining us for the beginning of this week's show, because it's a very special week here at Vanity Fair, is our West Coast editor, Britt Hennemuth. Hello, Britt.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Britt, you're here because the Hollywood issue is out in the world. It's an annual favorite of mine. I think all of us really grew up with these issues, reading them and, you know, imagining being part of something like this. And Britt, you are really in the trenches on the Hollywood issue more than any of the rest of us. It's really beautiful this year. So first of all, congratulations. How are you feeling now that people can see it?
Feels like we've given birth. It does. It is a 9-month ordeal, and it is exciting to see our baby out in the world. It was an incredible group of people. I think the last couple of years, as you'll recall, we focused really in your world of potential nominees and the Oscars race and sort of the exciting mix of ages and prestige projects and things like that. And this year, we really noticed that there was this rising class over the last couple of years of really tremendous actors that have sort of anointed themselves as the next wave. And none of them have been on a Hollywood cover before. So that was really important to us.
That's amazing. I kind of had to triple check that when I
know,
that.
Same. I was shocked.
And, you know, I think it speaks to how all of them, you know, some of them have been working forever. Some of them are just popping with, you know, a role or two in the last year, but they've really sort of anointed themselves as fixtures in our culture and fixtures in Hollywood. So I hear you. It's surprising that they, you know, it feels like a lot of them have been with us for a long time, but this is their first time. And it was a really fun mix.
I love that you didn't focus on Oscar contenders, and yet you have two on the front fold. It's like such a happy accident.
Well, we wanted the mix. You know, I think before it was like kind of just people campaigning. And this year we wanted, you know, the Oscar hopefuls, the box office hits, the, you know, you look at Selena Gomez, she's the most followed woman in Hollywood of her generation and has been at this for a long time and is now producing and obviously with a lot of attention for Only Murders and then the potential Working Girl reboot. There's just, you know, there's a lot of ways to be involved and be driving the conversation in Hollywood right now in and out of the Oscar race. So especially with this group of young people, you know, they're in Hollywood in ways that when we look back at some of the older Hollywood covers, talent couldn't be before. They're all really in control of their narrative. They're in control of who they are and the roles they pick and the projects they endorse. And several of them have production companies of their own, which, you know, even 5 years ago, people of their age did not have that sort of control. So it's fun to see all of them in the same room. And also what was so special is, you know, look, we wanted to take all safety precautions seriously, so we have not photographed a Hollywood issue quite like this in 3 years, where everyone was in the same room, everyone was able to sort of meet, and that's the special sauce that only Vanity Fair can do.
Yeah, so for my contribution to the cover, I talked to Austin Butler, who's right front and center, and he kind of talked about having worked with Selena Gomez when they were on Wizards of Waverly Place as children, and then also like running into Jonathan Majors over the course of the awards season circuit. So the idea that they're overlapping in all these ways in their lives and then kind of get to cross paths on this shoot, it feels like it's capturing a moment in a way that I think you only get when you get this like specific generation of people who have come up together and who are, you know, making their fortunes together too.
Totally. And it's funny because, you know, like to your point about Ana de Armas, she's been such a fixture for all of us with Blonde and the race and her performances. And but then to see her sort of meeting Selena Gomez, who she's known and been in her sort of cultural context for, you know, 20 plus years, however long Selena's been working, was kind of cute to see her fangirl out.
That is really cute. So, Rebecca, you talked to Jonathan Majors in terms of interviews for this cover. Did you talk to someone else besides him, too? I know some of us did double duty.
Yeah, Hoyeon.
Okay, yeah. So what did you learn just kind of getting that glimpse into this future of Hollywood from those interviews?
Well, I think, you know, it was really interesting because he kept talking about Michael B. Jordan's a movie star. And at one point I was like, Jonathan, you're becoming a movie star. You're like the lead bad guy in the Marvel movies. Like, and he was saying how he's kind of grappled with that word because in drama school, you know, that word was kind of a bad word. Like no one wanted to be a movie star. You wanted to be an actor and an artist and sort of taking on the responsibilities that come with, you know, that level of stardom and influence is something I think a lot of these young actors are still grappling with and sort of figuring out what is a movie star in this new generation, I thought was really interesting.
David, what did Florence Pugh have to say about being a movie star?
I think for Florence Pugh, she's coming off of a big and, to outside observers at least, somewhat dramatic year in which she had lead roles in Don't Worry, Darling and The Wonder. She politely declined to discuss Don't Worry, Darling and whatever happened around that. But she was very open and candid about particularly her relationship with social media, which is something a number of these cover subjects talk about because it is very, very difficult to, on the one hand, as someone with a huge public profile, reveal yourself in a way that is open and frank and vulnerable, all the things that we love from people on social media. And on the other hand, protect your privacy, protect your image, and protect what it is that people love about you. And Florence Pugh had a beloved Instagram coming into 2022. And then suddenly, every single post, every single word was scrutinized that she put out there. And she did talk very openly about having to negotiate exactly what her relationship to it is, having to put it away, and thinking more about the fact that she is a public figure and what that requires of her. So I did appreciate that. And I think you see with a lot of these people, to Britt's point, as they are sort of emerging as this new class, a negotiation around what that exactly entails for them as people who are leading a conversation.
I think the conversation around sort of protecting their mental health and also openly speaking about it is something really unique in this generation. Hoyeon, who starred in Squid Game and had this sort of insane rise to stardom, you know, talked about how she needed to sort of protect herself and take a break after the year that was Squid Game because it just became overwhelming for her mentally. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of young stars talk a lot more openly about mental health. So I think that's something that this generation really has put a value on and is sort of erasing that stigma with, which is really, I think, a positive change.
Yeah.
Britt, for people listening to the show, they might not realize that you generally know things well ahead of us. Like you're talking to people's reps a year before they have a big movie coming out that they think they have Oscar hopes for. You've kind of got the advance word. And, you know, for knowing as much about many of these people as you do and having followed their careers, what did you learn about this group by putting them all together in one place?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I do benefit definitely from sort of inheriting some semblance of putting this cover together. So people like, you know, part of the reason I work here is for this cover. Part of the reason we all do, we love this cover, and studios and publicity firms and agencies really love this cover too. So I hear about these performances and I hear about these things from people who don't even have any business in promoting performances to get friends or loved ones on this cover well in advance. I think what I learned this year about everyone is, and it's a boring, cheesy answer, but these are all great, nice people. And I'm not going to say that we've had years before that we weren't working with great, nice people, but there was not, to Rebecca's point and David's point, you know, they are erasing the stigmas around the sort of pratfalls of Hollywood. And these are, these are smart, solid artists, and they have a good head on their shoulders. And I know that's probably not the juiciest answer, but I learned that we're in good hands if this is the next wave of Hollywood.
Yeah, I love the optimistic tone that Anthony Breznican, our colleague, kind of struck in the essay he wrote to accompany this, being like, if this is who we've got, like, Hollywood is in good shape. And it's not necessarily the automatic thing people say. You know, we had the box office got better last year, but it's not necessarily solid. And even if movie star means something different for them than it did for Leonardo DiCaprio 30 years ago, I think you're right, Britt, that, like, they are going to lead us toward a brighter future or whatever it looks like.
And they have, you know, they oscillate so seamlessly between film, television, producing, documentary. You know what I mean? Like, they have a good handle on how the modern audience is consuming content. So, you know, in a world where there are a lot more movies, a lot more TV coming out, and we don't generate as an industry movie stars quite like we once did, they are certainly stars in their own right. And each of them have such specific fan bases as well. And that was really fun to sort of watch and glean from the reactions of people at the studio, sort of watching certain people working the front desk or PAs at Milk, just sort of, you know, just freaking out over Squid Games or freaking out over The Bear, or, you know, even one guy was like, I loved Bullet Train. Caleb Johnson was leaving. So, you know, it was a fun mix.
We are recording this before it's live, but we can definitely predict which of these images are going to be, are being talked about breathlessly on Twitter right now. Well, I mean, do we want to make predictions? I feel like
the Florence Pugh one.
I feel like Aaron Taylor Johnson, I mean, if this is not a huge thing right now, I will be surprised. But
we're
anyway,
not here to objectify anybody.
We're
but
not
there are
here
some
to
people,
objectify.
There are some people who are showing off incredible assets, and I think they deserve to be celebrated.
Absolutely. But yes, to that point, Britt, I'm curious just about what you can share of the concept of this very sexy, very enjoyable to look at shoot, and what it's like wrangling it. Because as you mentioned, you have to get all these people together, and it feels very complicated from our perspective.
I think that's where the 9 months come in. We have this vision, we have this idea, and then of course, it's planes, trains, automobiles. They are, you know, a dozen of the busiest, most prolific people of their generation. So to get them in the same room, same city at the same time does take 9 months. So, you know, and actually, I think some of my colleagues and I were speaking about this. I think this is the year that racks up the most frequent flyer miles. Today, we had people coming in from Jordan, Budapest, Paris, South Korea, London, Australia. I mean, people who participated in this cover were on the ground in LA, some of them for less than 24 hours, I think was the minimum. Some people came in to do this. They got their shot, slept, flew right back to a set. So a lot of thanks from Vanity Fair goes out to many of these participants who took long journeys to be there. But the concept really came from Stephen Klein, who photographed the cover this year. He was pulling references of the Viper Room, and sort of as we talked about this younger class, there were echoes of the Brat Pack and the 90s movie star and, you know, Leo and Kate Moss and Johnny Depp and people leaving the Viper Room and sort of what the Sunset Strip was to that sort of 90s heartthrob era. And so we wanted to sort of, we essentially rebuilt the Viper Room as our set. And then Patty Wilson, our incredible stylist, fresh off of her CFDA win, came in and sort of created this world where it was as if they had gone to the Oscars, then they'd perhaps gone to the Vanity Fair Oscar party, and then at 4 a.m, they'd found themselves at the Viper Room for one last ounce of celebration. And so they're, you know, dressed up in the sort of glamorous Vanity Fair Hollywood cover moment that we all love and know, but there is a more end of the night youthful twist to all of it, which is fun.
I love how the table seems sticky, even though it's not. Like, there's this, like, lived-in, grungy vibe about it. And that contrast is, I think, what makes it so exciting. Like, the details and seeing what everyone's wearing and the jewelry and the shoes and, like, whose hand is where. There's, like, that's my favorite part of a Hollywood cover, I think. It's, like, this painting that you can get lost in for hours.
Totally. I know we're pre-recording this, but I'm always surprised and I'm excited for tomorrow because I'm always surprised what people pick up. I remember the year that Elizabeth Debicki and Tessa Thompson's fingers were sort of touching, like,
yes,
like the Sistine Chapel. And it was like, it broke the internet for, and you know, we stare down this photo. We live in this picture for so long. It's almost like you miss these little moments that suddenly the world fixates on. So I'm excited for what's to come.
Well, Britt, we'll let you go. And you have some celebration of the Hollywood issue and some work to do. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Britt.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, we were gathering stars in many different locations, not just on the cover of the Vanity Fair Hollywood issue this week. Rebecca, over the weekend, you went up to Santa Barbara and you got to spend a lot of, like, way more quality time than I realized with the actors who were being acknowledged at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. How do Jamie Lee Curtis, Angela Bassett, and Cate Blanchett have the energy to be on stage for 2 hours at a film festival at this stage in the campaign?
Yeah, I had totally forgotten that these sit downs with them were 2 hours long. So about an hour in, I was like, this must be over soon. And then they keep going for another hour. And each of them was like Cate Blanchett turned to the person who was interviewing her and was like, this is a really deep dive, when his first question was like, where were you born? And I was like, oh, we're starting at the beginning here. But I think it's actually a pretty special event, because each of these honorees really gets to, like, dig deep and talk about their career, and they seem to sort of enjoy being able to go project by project, and there's clips that are shown, and I actually learned a lot about three actresses that I thought I sort of knew a lot about. It was Angela Bassett the first night, then Cate Blanchett, and then Jamie Lee Curtis. And it was sort of a funny order because they got progressively more candid, I guess is the word I'll use. So by the time you hit Jamie Lee Curtis, she was really, I mean, we've all talked about how she's been on this awards campaign. She doesn't hide much, and she had some of the funniest quotes I've ever heard. So it was a really enjoyable event. It's a nice campaign stop that I feel like is actually a pretty special moment with some of these nominees, and it's still going on. So there have been several other nominees since I left. So I think it was a really nice time.
Well, and then they went immediately from Santa Barbara, or I guess those three and many others, to the nominees luncheon, which David, you got to attend for us. There's a write-up of Santa Barbara that you did, Rebecca, on the site, and then also the Oscar nominees luncheon that you did, David. David, provided that you did not get COVID at this very crowded in-person event, seems like
too early to say.
Seems like you had a great time.
I did, except for when I and many, many, many other people got stuck behind the Tom Cruise vortex, which is to say
that sounds like a good time, though. I got to be honest.
It is, and it was maybe the one thing that felt brand new to this particular campaign cycle. You know, to Rebecca's point, we know a Jamie Lee Curtis wild monologue. We know how these people are messaging on the trail. We know the energy they bring. They know this excitement that follows them. Tom Cruise, this is his first major appearance of the season. And my God, could you feel it inside the room? I think Austin Butler followed him for about 15 minutes before they finally had a very long and very intimate conversation. But everyone who walked by him just seemed to kind of glow in his presence and all but bow down and thank him for saving theaters, including Steven Spielberg, Gigi Kwan, Angela Bassett. I mean, it was truly everybody. And to that point, you know, you have at this luncheon, what's so special about it is every single nominee gets their moment. And the vast majority of Oscar nominees are not stars. They are craftspeople, many of whom are being recognized for the first time. And so you have that interesting balance of complete stargazing and watching people who are a little more under the radar really getting a special moment. And that's what's unique and nice about this event.
I mean, Richard, for us who have not been in LA for this cycle, like if someone had told you ahead of time that Tom Cruise would be like the undisputed star of the Oscar luncheon, I might have been a little bit surprised. What about you?
Yeah, but I think it works so well that, like David said, he has been kind of off the campaign. You forget he is a producer on a Best Picture nominee, and so he was going to show up at some point. And to have it be this grand formal event where nothing is at stake at that afternoon, you know, like everyone can celebrate together. We're the class of 2023, 2022, depending on how you want to frame it. I believe they said 2023 they took the picture. Like, I think that was like well placed. And, you know, if you talk about in years past, like Sony Pictures Classics running a really smart game with the father and holding it till the very end, and it was the last thing people saw, and then Hopkins won. Like, I don't know, maybe you deploy Tom Cruise judiciously and later in the campaign to get everyone saying, wait a second, Top Gun, that was great, and it did save the movie industry, and maybe I should vote for that for Best Picture. I don't know how much strategy was necessarily involved. Maybe he just wanted to show up because it's cool that, you know, he's nominated as a producer, but... yeah, I mean, I watched the video. There's a long video of just reading every single name as they all get up on the risers and, you know, various stagehands tell people where to stand. And, like, when Tom Cruise was later in that whole lineup and when he was announced, like, you even just through the grainy YouTube video, like, you could feel the shift in the room. And it was nice that they sat him next to his Mission Impossible co-star Angela Bassett, and they seemed to have a fun little gab. And yeah, I mean, he's a big, big movie star and probably the biggest in the world at the moment for good reason. So it's cool that he was there.
I really like seeing him reunite with Steven Spielberg in the video that someone captured because, you know, War of the Worlds was a weird time for both of them and a very strange time in Tom Cruise's, you know, movie star career. But I guess time and Oscar nominations heal all wounds. And, you know, the two of them are natural allies in trying to save movies. And I think Spielberg was really giving Cruise that credit that you were saying, Richard. Like, he did it. He did the thing that no one thought was possible.
We had been talking about for months, I feel like this summer, maybe that's because we were starved for other things to talk about before the fall festivals. But like, where it was like, oh, maybe Top Gun just is the front runner. And that language has changed a lot because of various other projects, you know, getting ahead of it and winning more awards and stuff like that. But like, I don't know, just watching the reaction to Tom Cruise at this luncheon, I mean, again, from afar, maybe I shouldn't have placed it so far down my Best Picture possible winners. Like, it might be a lot higher than I thought.
Oh, exact same. And I think it is the effect of exactly what you're saying, which is this strategic deployment, which I do think it is to an extent. I think everyone involved in that campaign, it is a Paramount movie. There are a lot of very knowledgeable people involved in it, knew exactly what would happen when he walked into that room because he had not been walking into rooms like that for several months. And it's Tom Cruise, and he's been this mythic figure jumping out of planes on Twitter and doing these insane things and getting a lot of celebration for it pretty widely. You know, we talk about this a lot. When you go to an event like this, it's one, where the eye's going, and two, who seems to have some kind of momentum or who seems to be capturing people in a way that we hadn't seen a month ago. And so this was an interesting event because on the one hand, you had this explosion of love for Tom Cruise and, as a byproduct, Top Gun Maverick. It did feel like every time someone involved in that movie got announced, there was a little bit louder applause, and for the average like sound editor or something like that, it really was a very present nominee in that room. But on the other hand, I would say the loudest applause came for Everything Everywhere All at Once, for Stephanie Hsu, for Michelle Yeoh, for the Daniels. It was really clear that, as we've been noticing, the love for that movie is very strong. So those were the two that popped. One that we've talked about a ton as a frontrunner, and one that, yeah, as you say, Richard, had kind of fallen off from at least our conversations around who's really in it. It may be premature, or just I'm still in that Cruise glow, that Cruise glow of the Beverly Hilton.
But breathing the same air as Tom Cruise has an effect on your brain.
Being stuck in a line with hundreds of people trying to get around him. But, you know, I did leave that feeling like the movie was more of a player than I entered. And if it, say, wins something like Producers Guild, where he is being honored, where that is its most friendly audience, it will be taken very seriously.
It does feel like PJ will give it an additional boost. And I don't know, I wasn't there, but seeing on Twitter, like, is there not, Tom Cruise hugged every single famous person in that room from what it looks like on social media. And I mean, it's funny that we were just talking about, like, what is a movie star with the Hollywood issue? Because, like, Tom Cruise is the last great giant movie star from his, I don't know, from his era. And to see him work a room like that is pretty, pretty incredible. And it's funny, I've had a couple conversations with people who feel like Tom Cruise, I mean, feel like Top Gun is a real contender to win Best Picture. And I hadn't really been entertaining that, but it does feel like that's something we should take seriously after this.
We had a listener the other week bring up, you know, the preferential ballot stuff. And like, my experience since Top Gun came out, not necessarily talking to people in the industry, but also people in the industry, is just like, what movies have you seen? What did you like? Everyone has said Top Gun at some point to me, you know? And it just seems to be like a consensus thing. And so maybe people put their little pet favorite at number one and they say, ah, but you know, number two, Top Gun. And then by the magic of numbers, that's how it wins. Or they put it as number one. I don't know. But I think that, the enduring popularity of that movie and its star, despite his, you know, some controversial aspects of his personal life, that's a pretty strong ticket, the likes of which you don't see a lot these days.
Yeah, there are a lot of Rhodes reporters like myself who attend this event, and I was talking to one of them, and the person said to me, like, but it's going to be Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I said, but can it be that easy? And on the one hand, it's like it is checking all the boxes, but Nomadland aside, every year lately, it has not been that easy. And so it is, I think it is a valid and worthy effort to think about who the challenger is and when they might emerge. Because there are a few different movies that could pop at different places. Like if Banshees were the challenger, it would probably pop at BAFTA. If it were something like Top Gun, it would be at PGA. And, you know, you follow the trail of excitement and then you follow the math for them, how they would perform on a preferential ballot, and you can see the path. And yeah, I think that this movie does have a path, and it is worth considering those different paths because it's never that simple anymore with this preferential ballot.
And is it any indication? I mean, look, we're still a month out, but like for a movie like Top Gun Maverick that is ripe for backlash in terms of like its valorization of the American military industrial complex and imperialism.
I didn't notice that theme in the movie, Richard. I'm interested in how you found that.
Well, you know, cheering on bombing a faceless enemy. It doesn't matter who they are. Let's just bomb them. you know, like that issue came up when the movie was out and people were saying, oh, like, you know, you're cheering on this horrible thing. And I don't disagree with those people, to be honest, but at the same time, like, we're now months later into, and it's nominated for Best Picture. I haven't heard a peep like that, you know? Nope. Like, that backlash, if it's coming, has not yet. And I also think that's a particular backlash that, like, enough people in the Academy are just deaf to or immune to or whatever. Like, that's not going to get under their skin the way that something else might.
It's kind of such an advantage to not be the front runner, right? I think that conversation would have happened.
I mean, that's really what I'm saying, exactly.
Yeah, it's like we would have been having that conversation if people really had felt threatened by this film or felt like it was the front runner. And it has sort of flown under the radar, guys, for all season. So I think that's why it hasn't come up, which is sort of, I don't think they did it on purpose, but it's a real smart move by the awards strategist behind it.
Well, we should talk about schedule for a little bit because you guys mentioned PGA, which is on the 25th. It's the day before the SAGs, which are on the 26th. This coming weekend, there's the BAFTAs, as you mentioned, David, and then also DGA, where Joseph Kaczynski is nominated for Top Gun. Like, is it crazy to wonder if that is where a Top Gun surge could happen? I've been kind of assuming it's going to be Spielberg because I still think he's going to win Best Director, but not, you got me wondering, David.
I'm wondering, This feels like a major stop. This feels like a real potential turning point in the race. You know, last year we knew Jane Campion was going to win director, regardless of whether or not Power of the Dog won Best Picture. And that can happen sometimes, like Alfonso Cuarón, really in both of the years that he won. But this year, I don't know. Spielberg winning would affirm he can still win director without winning picture, but it's a pretty fluid race. And anyone else who wins it, I think, immediately emerges as, if not the challenger, if not the, you know, new frontrunner, then the challenger. And then if Everything Everywhere All at Once wins the DGA, it is the undisputed frontrunner for Best Picture and would be very difficult to take it down, I think, in the same way that, like, Ben Affleck won for Argo here, even though he wasn't even nominated by the directing branch at the Academy. The DGA can sometimes tip the race for picture even more than director.
So then what if Kaczynski wins director and then a DGA?
Yeah, that's a great example.
He's not nominated at the Oscars, so...
If Kaczynski wins director, I would predict Top Gun Maverick to win Best Picture, to be honest with you.
Whoa. That didn't even occur to me like a week ago.
Yeah, but I mean, where is the love for that movie is the question. Mm-hmm. If there's that much love for the movie in the Directors Guild.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big statement.
Yeah, that would be huge if that happens.
That would be a fascinating... this year of movies has been so dominated by all the uncertainty about the box office. And, like, are movies back? Can they come back? Will anyone go see anything? And for Top Gun Maverick to win Best Picture, like, it makes a certain kind of sense. It is, in many ways, the movie of 2022, more so than The Fablemans or Everything Everywhere All at Once. Or, like, even Avatar, really, like, which made more money, but, like, I don't think has the same kind of, like, cultural dominance that Top Gun really still does. And that's coming from me, a big Avatar fan, so please.
I was just going to say, it is interesting how little of a presence you felt of Avatar in that room at the luncheon.
Who was there? I mean, I guess a bunch of the...
John Lando, the producer, was there. Some of the Below the Line folks who are nominated. But for a movie that is already one of the highest grossing movies of all time, and that is a Best Picture nominee, yeah, it was very quiet. And all that noise about... you know, impact on movie theaters, impact on cinema, went to Top Gun Maverick, it felt like.
That's so
David,
interesting.
I'm curious, you know, I noticed there were some notable people missing, and I'm curious of not having, like, Andrea Riseborough there or Barry Keoghan, if you felt that there were sort of people missing from that room, or if it didn't matter because it's so packed anyway.
Yeah, you do notice. I think Barry less so because the Banshees crew is so fun. And Colin Farrell and Kerry Condon are just everywhere and having a great time. And Martin McDonagh was there as well. So
Brendan Gleeson was there too, right?
Brendan Gleeson was there. Yeah, I mean, maybe not as social as Kerry or Colin. But yes, he was there. He was smiling. But I think you noticed really the Best Actress category. I thought it was fascinating that both Ana de Armas and Andrea Riseborough were not there. Two, in their own ways, controversial nominees. Ana more for her movie, Andrea Riseborough for reasons I refuse to get into.
We will go back again and listen to the archives. We've been there.
Yes, listen to the past month of episodes of Little Gold Men. But you had Kate and Rochelle there, and they both looked amazing. They are really running a tight race. It's the kind of thing where if the frontrunners are there, you notice, and if the people who are challenging that are not there, it almost tightens further and it narrows. So that's really where I noticed it, was in that particular category.
Well, you mentioned Kate Blanchett, and I realize we haven't taken the moment to promote another exciting issue of Vanity Fair that is out this week, which is the second awards issue with Kate Blanchett on the cover and a cover story written by one David Canfield. David, I asked Britt how he's feeling with his child out in the world. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very relieved. This was an undertaking for sure. Kate Blanchett is a fascinating, tricky person to profile, but it was a piece that I'm proud of and that took really a lot of work just to sort of get my head around it. So I'm glad it's over.
Well, it's kind of part of her Oscar season narrative too. Like, she's been really famous for a really long time. She has two Oscars. Like, it's not like there's new discoveries to be made about Kate Blanchett, I don't think, even more so than like Michelle Yeoh, who's had a long career, but hasn't necessarily gotten the same level of attention. But what I think your story just does so well is kind of get into how her brain works and how she's still grappling with things about her career and about Tar and about the roles that she's played. Like, it really kind of gave her space to wrestle. Cate Blanchett wrestles with Cate Blanchett in some way, which was not an easy thing to pull off.
Yeah, and that was a really organic result of what it was like to spend some time with her. because I really had no idea what to expect. And two things for me have really emerged in her campaign this season. One is the shadow of Lydia Tarr, real or not. She is very real to Cate Blanchett. And it is quite clear that she has not shaken this role, this experience. And there is something to listening to her try to figure that out and struggling to at times about what she connected to in the material, what is kind of haunting her about the experience, which I think is a fair word to use based on, you know, my experience with her and my understanding of what it was like for her. And then the other element of it is this incredibly larger than life presence she occupies at this point in Hollywood, in pop culture. A lot of the folks I spoke with about her, ranging from, you know, character actors who worked with her a lot, like Melanie Lynskey and Bruce Greenwood, to Oscar-winning directors like Martin Scorsese and Alejandro Iñárritu, all talk about her as if she is this figure who, when she enters a room, not only, I think it was David Hare, the playwright, who told me, there is zero possibility of not knowing she's in that room. And then all eyes get going toward her and feeling like you are in the presence of something greater than human, if that makes sense. And, you know, kind of trying to get at that a little bit and talking to, you know, those who've worked with her and also talking to her about that. And yeah, this story is the result of my very complicated feelings around all that, which I've tried to articulate and maybe didn't so well. So I apologize.
I mean, Rebecca, you were just in a room with her. Is that true? You can't not know that Cate Blanchett's in the room with you?
100%. I felt like David did such a great job of capturing that, even from like his lead anecdote. And there is something just so mesmerizing about her that is sort of hard to put into words. And I'm looking forward to your follow-up piece, David, on the increased demand of sheep's milk, which I assume is going to happen.
I think we all need to have a glass of sheep's milk on the day of the Oscars.
Oh, I was planning on a sheep's milk latte. If I have to commit to the full sheep's milk, I mean, for Kate,
No, we'll do a latte. Okay. We'll do a latte. That's what she wanted.
I need to ease
do,
my so. Way into sheep's milk, I think.
I think the true discovery of the piece was a friend texting me. He said, "Wait, David Canfield lived in New Zealand?" And I was like, "I don't think I knew that."
Indeed.
He reveals it. So I also just like our commitment to including Melanie Lynskey in as many locations and ways as we can. She's an excellent voice in your piece, as she has been in every other interview we've ever done with her.
On a purely like appreciative note, she gives a great secondary interview, and there is a particular art to that of giving you great, you know, anecdotes. And this was actually another interesting part of reporting out the story. When I spoke to Bruce Greenwood, he told me at the end of our interview, "I really wanted to come up with like a great image and anecdote for you because like Cate deserves that." And
Wow. People
actually putting effort into planning to talk about her was a first for me. And that also kind of informed the tone of the story, I think.
Live your life in a way that makes Bruce Greenwood want to tell a good story about you, I think. I can use that going forward.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All Well, the awards issue is going out to awards voters now, and the pieces will continue rolling out online. I don't want to spoil anything, so maybe we'll save more discussion of it next week. Rebecca, you've got some great pieces in it. I got to do some fun interviews, too. Richard, you've got a great essay kind of breaking down the acting race. So we'll talk more about it. So should we close by saying who we think is going to win, Kate or Michelle? Do we want to do a temperature check?
Oh, God.
I mean, you talked about being tight race, David, at the luncheon. And, you know, we all, you know, now got this sense about Top Gun from it. Is there any sense of distance getting between the two of them right now?
I truly think it's so close. I really, it is a nail biter. It's a nail biter. And Richard, I think you said last week, this is one of those weird years where SAG isn't going to tell us anything. I mm-hmm. think that's totally true. I feel like it is not going to be known until the night of. Right now, I would predict Kate Blanchett purely because she's just won a little bit more. And the undeniability of that performance has yet to be punctured, I guess.
And also, it's a really major way to give that movie an award. Where, yes. you know, it's has stiff competition elsewhere. I mean, it has stiff competition in Best Actress, but... she is that movie. She is Tar, you know? And I feel like if people want... obviously, the Academy liked that movie because they got nominations I didn't expect it to get in editing and... was it score? Cinematography?
Yeah. Cinematography, yeah.
Yeah. I think that that's the slight edge in the disadvantage to Michelle Yeoh, weirdly, is that her movie is so widely liked and is likely to win elsewhere that mm-hmm. she could kind of weirdly be the victim of that.
Yeah, I saw Jamie Lee Curtis say this, and it might have been at Santa Barbara, actually, Rebecca, you can tell me, that basically the reason that you can call me Oscar nominee Jamie Lee Curtis is because of Michelle Yeoh. Like, she basically credited Michelle Yeoh as the guiding force of that movie, which the Daniels have done as well. You know, they couldn't have made that movie without someone of her stature. So the idea of Everything Everywhere All at Once, Best Picture victory being for her, like, I guess if I'm Michelle Yeoh, I feel good about that. If maybe I would also like the Oscar to take home. But it does really make sense as a trade-off, as you were saying, Richard.
Rebecca, who do you predict?
I would predict Kate Blanchett as well. I mean, in our jobs, I think we lean so much on precursors who's won yeah. what before. So I think we have to do less of that because things have been getting more unpredictable. I feel like the Everything Everywhere All at Once campaign has maybe realized that Michelle is the one category where she has a huge battle, and have been mentioning it more, as Jamie Lee Curtis did, that this movie could not have been made without her. And, you know, it to me, I would love to see her win. And I think it's so neck and neck that it could still happen. But yeah, if we're looking at the numbers, it feels like Kate's is definitely still a slight bit ahead.
One thing I keep seeing thrown out online, which I totally understand why, is like, but Kate Blanchett already has two, and I think there has been precedent in the past of the Academy trying to spread that wealth over the years, but like, not really, you know. Frances no. McDormand winning, you know, within what, 2 years of itself. I mean, Hilary Swank ditto, that was a long time ago at this point, but like Mahershala Ali, Christoph Waltz, like I don't know that metric is really applied at all these days.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it would be nice if it was.
But yeah, sure. Like, if you win one, you're not eligible for another one for 5 years or something.
And in your piece, David, you kind of mentioned the company that she would be in as a tweet. I think, you know, Meryl Streep. Who else would Bergman. She be joining? Ingrid Bergman. And then they would all be behind Katharine Hepburn with four. You know, if anyone's going to join that company, Kate Blanchett is worthy of it. So that seems like it would not stop people.
Frances McDormand is the other one, and she won a pretty fluid race for a movie that was a big overall contender, obviously won Best Picture, Best Director. But I remember that talking point in that year, mm-hmm. and yes, it's an asterisk year, et cetera, but the question was, is she really going to win again for her, what was a, you know, pretty subtle performance? I thought a beautiful one, and she did.
Yeah.
And the Academy votes for who they want to win, and I agree with Richard. They don't really care if you've just won. In fact, that might even, for some, you know, enhance the possibility of, you know, anointing them in a special way.
And maybe, you know, if Kate Blanchett wins, she could be like, no, I've won two Oscars for a Martin Scorsese film and a Todd Field film. There is not a third film from a different director that I don't know what you're talking about.
Also that. Speaking of asterisks.
maybe to wrap it up, should we do a similar gut check on Best Actor? David, you mentioned Austin Butler kind of being in the Tom Cruise orbit and, you know, the Banshees crew being around. Did you get any read on who's popping in that group?
So as I'm watching Austin Butler closely in Tom Cruise's ear, laughing and listening intently, I thought to myself on the spot, this is how he wins. So I'm predicting Austin Butler now.
Ooh.
Was Brendan Fraser there?
Yes, he was. And he was all over. But I don't know. Ever since the nominations came out and The Whale underperformed outside of the acting branch, it's harder to see his path. And I just didn't get the, you know, there wasn't that thunderous, you know, comeback applause for him. In fact, Colin Farrell got louder applause than he did, which and it can sound so stupid measuring the exact volume of
it's
applause,
all a popularity but these things,
it really is informative. Coda got the most applause. Parasite got the most applause. It does tell us a lot. And yeah, I also thought Colin Farrell popped a lot. So, but and, right now I'm going with Austin Butler.
And look, there's precedent for this. In the case of Mickey Rourke, the nomination was the comeback. In the case of Michael Keaton, the nomination was the comeback. It wasn't the win. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at this point.
It's interesting that you ask, was he there? Because I feel like I also didn't know if he was there. And I know we're just taking this in from afar. But when we're talking about heat, it does feel like, I don't know. I think I'm still going with Colin for the moment. But we'll see. We've got SAG to go and a couple other things. But to me, it feels like Colin versus Austin at the moment as well.
Do we feel like SAG could tell us who's winning Best Actor, unlike Best Actress?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because I don't know that it's as close necessarily. I just think we don't know, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because there's kind of a wild card in Brendan Fraser. And also, I think in this movie's case, BAFTA, if Colin Farrell wins BAFTA, I don't think that necessarily means he wins the Oscar. It just means he kind of has to win that. Mm-hmm. So it's a different set of dynamics. Whereas with Kate and Michelle, like, it can be any number of seesawing, but I think the margin is thin enough where, you know, and the groups are different enough where it's not really make or break in the same way.
Yeah. That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. I feel like we should go ahead and let you all know that next week we're doing our 2003 Oscars flashback episode, bringing back our friends Joe Reed and Chris File to talk about the 2003 ceremony, the movies in 2002. We'll be talking about Chicago and The Hours, etc. So, if you want to go brush up on your acceptance speeches or anything else to watch along with us, it's going to be really fun. And of course, we'll talk about DGA, BAFTA, and all the other awards news of this year, not just 2003. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram in the meantime at VF Awards Insider or on Twitter on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca M. Ford.
And the Hollywood issue is on newsstands. The Awards Insider issue is in your mailbox if you're an awards voter, or you can read the stories online. We have so much good stuff to promote. What a great time of year this is. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of watching Brianna float above Arizona during the Super Bowl halftime show goes to Rebecca Ford.
There is something just so mesmerizing about her.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.